Good evening, welcome Behind the News for July 14, 2005, Bastille Day. And this is the special cultural edition of Behind the News. We've got two guests lined up for tonight. First, waiting in the studio here is Gary Indiana, author of a new book called Schwarzenegger Syndrome, Politics and Celebrity in the Age of Contempt. Arnie, not looking quite as grand as he did a few months ago, at least if the polls are to be believed, but still an amazing phenomenon, leaving the world of science fiction and entering the governor's mansion in California, which is another species of science fiction, I suppose. And then at the bottom of the hour, an interview recorded earlier today with Susan Willis, author of Portents of the Real, a primer for post-9/11 America, just out from Verso. And boy, film people all over town today. Just around my office in Soho, they're filming a GlaxoSmithKline diabetes drug ad and blocking up all the sidewalks, and I'm walking down Wall Street to get here, and Channel One is blocking all the sidewalks. The arrogance of the media is boundless, but not here. We're, of course, very modest and unassuming. Just a couple of words on the economic news before we get to Gary Indiana, because lots of things to talk to him about, Arnie and such. First of all, last Friday, as reported by the Bureau of Labor Statistics, that just a little under 150,000 jobs created last month, considerably below expectations and well below the post-World War II average. Post-World War II average would be about 220, and if you just look at expansionary periods, which is what we're supposedly in, it would be over 300,000. So we're getting two-thirds to half of the rate of job creation that we'd normally expect. The unemployment rate did fall to 5%, but a lot of that is because people are just dropping out of the labor force or not reentering. We're still about 2 percentage points below where we were at the peak in 1999-2000. If we're looking at the percentage of the adult population that's employed. So the unemployment rate flattered by the fact that lots of people have pretty much given up on the job search or something. It's not fully understood what's going on, but that number not as good as it looks on the surface. It was reported this morning, however, that retail sales very strong last month, led upward by a very strong performance in cars, but everything else across the board. People are buying stuff like crazy. And also in the New York Times today, article reporting that the bottom half of the income distribution is really lagging, wages going nowhere. But a couple of pundits were summoned to opine that this was of no great macroeconomic significance because rich people have money and they're spending it. So there you go. We've got at least half of the population going nowhere economically, but it doesn't really matter, or so the New York Times tells us. So let's take a little musical break with an old David Bowie song to introduce Gary Indiana.
It must strain you to look down so far from your father's house. And I know what a louse like me in his house could do for you. I'm the cream of the great utopia dream, and you're steam in the depths of your bank of spleen. Yeah.
And that really old David Bowie song from Space Oddity, Unwashed and Somewhat Slightly Dazed, in which he professes that he's a phallus in pigtails. Not quite the appropriate introduction to Arnold Schwarzenegger, but Gary Indiana, who's got a new book out called Schwarzenegger Syndrome from the New Press, has several pages in it on how Arnie represents the breastification of the male. And I really wanted to know more about the breastification of the male. So what's that all about?
Well, that was actually an idea suggested by an essay by Richard Hawkins, who's an artist in Los Angeles. He worked in a used bookstore years ago where Arnold was a regular customer and got Arnold to autograph numerous books like Plato's Symposium and Arthur Simon's Love's Body or something like that. And collected enormous Arnoldiana. And he did refer in this actually inventory of his Arnold collection, which included such things as cigar ash from Arnold's cigar, the term breastification, which has to do, of course, with the gay, that period of, well, I guess it's still current.
Still in some, Chelsea, isn't
in
it?
Chelsea, where men developed breasts, essentially.
But hard ones, not soft ones. Like
hard, yeah. Which to me is inexplicable. I never understood why men would want breasts. But my theory in Arnold's case is that he would like to be the first completely self-sufficient human being. If you'll remember, he had that movie where he became pregnant with one of implanted fertilized egg of Emma Thompson. And, you know, not only had the breast, but also the baby. And so he was both man and woman.
This is very weird for a guy who on the surface looks like the image of the macho man himself. How do you read this secret androgyny of Arnold Schwarzenegger?
Well, I don't know that it's so much androgyny as a sort of androidiny. To my way of thinking, I see him as a kind of replicant of some sort of physical ideal that was taken too far, to, as I said in the book, almost to the extent of the Botero painting look that few people deliberately cultivate. I think it has something to do with wanting to be steel-like, powerful in a extra human way, and well, that's useful for getting your way with people that are smaller and weaker or female or whatever.
And you do point out that his famous epithet, girly man, isn't sometimes read as homophobia, but you think it's more misogynistic.
Yes, I do think it's I didn't interpret that as a homophobic remark because, first of all, I don't think he is homophobic. I do think he's misogynistic to a pretty dramatic degree.
All right, well, let's go back into history and review Arnold's past. Immigrant from Austria, a father with at least some links to the Nazi Party.
He was in the Nazi Party.
Was in the Nazi Party. Arnold came here. It's sometimes said he thinks he's on a mission of sorts. Could you talk about the early history of Arnold?
Well, he grew up in Graz and in Styria. And you know, his father was local police commissioner in Graz. His mother was someone we don't know that much about, but I'm pretty sure quite a passive victim of the father, who was known to be a drunkard and rather brutal in his cups. He developed at a very rather precocious age this interest in bodybuilding. He ran away several times to compete in amateur and then professional bodybuilding events in Germany and later England. He went AWOL in his compulsive military service at one point in order to be in one of these things. It seemed to have been his response to feelings of helplessness in the presence of his father, but I'm not sure.
And then how did he find his way over here?
A guy named George Wider, who was basically a huckster, brought him over to perform for $100 a pop what were called sort of King Kong type feats of strength, for various commercial enterprises. George Wider and his brother were also involved in developing a vitamin and steroid empire, and also entrepreneurs of physique magazines and of physique competitions. They have continued to, it's become an empire. A lot of the vitamins, they own Schiff Vitamins, for example.
Oh, really? And then Arnie himself was somewhat popular in the gay stroke books of the 70s.
He was. He was somebody's image of perfection. And, of course, it was one of those images of perfection that got purveyed and prescribed for the entire gay world, which I think probably a micro fraction of which actually wanted to look like that, or, the Tom of Finland sort of hyper physique thing. He lent himself to that, and in my book, I refer to that not as necessarily an indication that he had homosexual doings or not, but that he was developing a consensus of an audience for himself.
And then was Pumping Iron then his first experience in the movies?
I believe that his first experience in the movies was something called Hercules in New York, in which he was paired with Arnold Stang, who you may recall from many years ago as the pitchman for Chunky candy, chocolate. Arnold Stang's famous line was, "What a chunk of chocolate."
Oh, yes.
And he was paired as, they were like the Mutt and Jeff of this terrible movie. And his name in that film, he was credited as Arnold Strong, as a foil to Arnold Stang. But the first real movie, I believe, that he did was actually a cameo in you couldn't call it really, but a non-speaking part in Robert Altman's Long Goodbye, in which he played a bodyguard for one of the heavies. And then the first film that he co-starred with other stars in was Stay Hungry with Jeff Bridges and Sally Fields. And then I believe Pumping Iron came after that.
And there's that. The only thing I remember from that movie is when he tricks his friend into yelping on stage and convinces him it's the thing that everybody's doing. There's some weirdly clever sadism to that gave me the creeps, but also said this guy's going somewhere.
Well, in Stay Hungry, Bob Rafelson managed to humanize Arnold in a very interesting way. He made him almost a Buddhist. And then, contrary-wise, when you see Pumping Iron, you see that he really is a sadistic or let's say takes a very sadistic attitude towards people he feels competitive with, because even his best friend at the time, who was another bodybuilder, he would humiliate regularly and undermine, and he had all kinds of little tricks that he would pull. He'd build people up to tear them down and things like that.
And there's that story when he's in bed with his friend's wife and he has her call and say, I can't say the word on
well,
the air.
He actually dialed the husband without telling her who he was calling, and handed her the phone. And then he grabbed the phone away and he said, "I just effed your wife. I just effed your wife."
Nice guy. I was speaking with Gary Indiana, author of Schwarzenegger Syndrome, Politics and Celebrity in an Age of Contempt. And you quote something. This is in a Spy magazine article from, I guess, the late 80s, early 90s, the days of Spy magazine, in which a biographer of Arnie's had to promise to exclude material dealing with Arnold's homosexual experiences, his use of steroids, his sale of steroids, his theft of automobiles, or his involvement in passport forgery. What do you make of that?
Well, what was interesting about this injunction or this communique from his lawyers was that the author of the book had no notion of any of these activities and wondered why these preemptive things about car theft and so on were coming into it. Obviously, the lawyers knew something she didn't. She had no she wasn't purporting any of this.
And have we ever found out anything since, or is this still shrouded in mystery?
I would imagine that, like many things to do with Arnold, it's not just shrouded mystery. It's shredded to the point where we won't ever come to the, you know, for example, the anthrax attack on the tabloid building in Boca Raton, you know, effectively, the government did Arnold the favor of destroying the archives of all of the compromising photographs of him ever taken.
Ooh, how convenient. Which
and now our former mayor, Rudolph Giuliani, has the headquarters of his security company in that building, which he decontaminated. It was the headquarters of the Star and all the tabloids. And it was interesting that the anthrax that was sent to the art director there and to several other people there was lethalized. It was weaponized anthrax, whereas the stuff that was sent to Daschle and others was not, and the news media. The people that got – oh, no, it was Daschle and the other one. Yes, they got weaponized anthrax. The stuff that was sent to the news media was not weaponized anthrax, and it came with a note that said, "Take penicillin immediately." We spelled penicillin wrong, but nevertheless, I gave him a heads up.
Oh, okay, we're moving along in time. So let's fast forward to Arnie's movie career. And I get the impression that you said something to the effect that this was watching Arnie's movies is not as excruciating an experience as you might suspect.
I find some of them very enjoyable as...
I think he's very funny in a way.
He can be. I was talking to Gabriel Byrne about working with him a couple months ago, and he said he was a really interesting, well, he used some other language too, but that it was quite an experience working with him on End of Days, there's something very formidable about his presence on set, and that he can carry things off that are surprising considering the stereotype of him.
But this is where he developed the android image and...
Well, he likes to play... Well, of course, he had these forays into comedy, which were not unsuccessful for the most part. But I think what he really... I mean, he's enormously clever in terms of dealing with his limits. For instance, he chose to play the Terminator in the first Terminator rather than the Michael Biehn role of the human sent back because he realized that Michael Biehn had all of the expository dialogue and that his strength would be to be laconic and say almost nothing.
He's very good at that.
Well, that was something Andy Warhol used to tell people, is say, you know, don't move, don't speak. It's the most powerful thing you can do on camera.
And then, let's move now to the political career of Arnold Schwarzenegger. The recall was something that from this distance, from 3,000 miles away, unfolded like a very strange event. At first it said, this can't really be happening. Then it really happened, and then, my God, Arnie is governor. What were the origins of this whole recall movement?
A little murky, because this was hatched by People's Advocate, which is an organization in Sacramento that was originated by the people who brought you Proposition 13, which basically destroyed the tax base of California by freezing property taxes at a ridiculously low level, where they still are. It's a right-wing organization which has a kind of ingenuity in convincing working-class people to vote against their own interests, because in California you have the ballot. You have the ballot initiative, you have the referendum, and you have the recall. The recall has been tried with every governor in the history of California, but it has only succeeded in the case of Gray Davis. They militated in favor of this and got it going almost before Gray Davis was reelected. And then this criminal congressman, Darrell Issa, and I can say that because he's been indicted many times for car theft, arson, and
they made a fortune selling car alarms.
Yeah. Then he made a fortune selling car alarms. Well, he had some expertise in the area. He had run unsuccessfully for the Senate at one point, and then successfully for the House by pumping $7 point something million into an uncontested election. And that was exactly the same amount that he put into the petition drive. It was essential that they get the special election scheduled before the regularly scheduled Democratic primary, because Schwarzenegger, first of all, would never have gotten a nomination of the Republican Party. And in the regular election, there would have been a huge Democratic turnout. They needed to have this scheduled exactly when it happened. And the petition drive got off to a slow start. Issa pumped all this money into it. He got the signatures. And then he wanted to be governor himself. But then when Arnold came in, he had to quit because he knew he didn't have a chance.
And the state, of course, was a mess after the electricity dereg scandal, which, of course, Enron was manipulating enormously.
Yeah, and that was the other purpose of getting Gray Davis out, because Bustamante, the lieutenant governor, had initiated a lawsuit against Enron and six other Texas-based energy companies that had basically ripped California off for $9 billion, and their lawyers were offering 2 cents on the dollar as a settlement, and they weren't accepting it. The lawsuit was going to proceed, and had Davis stayed in office, it would have gone to court. But once he was kicked out and preempted by Arnold, the lawsuit was mooted and doesn't exist anymore.
But then Arnie, of course, trading on his movie reputation, was going to come in and clean everything up, terminate all California's problems.
Well, he may terminate California, but I don't know about California's problems.
But the problems are terrible fiscal shape, declining educational system, just a big old mess.
Doesn't look – his future there doesn't look as bright as it
did. Yeah, his poll numbers are pretty bad. Right?
Because essentially California is a mess, and he wants to make it more of a mess by putting even more of these – the progressive reforms that Hiram Johnson brought in at the beginning of the last century were intended to get the power of the Southern Pacific Railroad out. They were running the whole state. But as with the law of unintended consequences, now you have a budget. Now you have a referendum every time you turn around in California. He wants to have more. He wants to have more local elections on. He wants to have more statewide special ballot initiatives, special referendums on everything. which makes it virtually impossible to have a budget.
Well, it also makes it manipulable by big money and propagandists.
Absolutely. And unfortunately, as with Proposition 13, the propagandists of large corporations are really skillful at making poor people believe that they're getting a good deal by making other people rich.
And the talk show people are going crazy about all the immigrants. That was the source of all of California's problems, was all the Mexicans.
Yes, they didn't want them to have driving license. They wanted them to blow the leaves off their $4 million lawns, and they wanted, you know, them to wash their cars and their kitchen floors and take care of their children, but they didn't want them to have driving licenses. They wanted them to take public transportation, and as we know, there is none in Los Angeles, and hardly any in the whole state except in San Francisco.
So for a while it looked like we should be scared of Arnie. You know, there's that constitutional amendment to allow a non-native born to become president, and it looked like we had an Arnie in our future. But and he's looking a little rocky now. Should we be worried?
About him? No, I don't think so. I think we should be worried about about the Schwarzenegger syndrome.
What's that?
Which is the conflation conflation of celebrity of any kind with competence in any field. In other words, if you're a movie star, then you should be able to run a electronics empire. People think because somebody's famous. I mean, I've always said that the trouble with American culture is that only celebrities are thought to have real existence, and no one else really exists. And this culture of celebrity that empowers famous people, whether they're famous for anything worthwhile or not, is a disaster for this country.
Doesn't seem to be any sign of a way out of this right now, does it?
Well, I don't see any in the foreseeable future. I do think ultimately this kind of bubble has to implode, but I don't know when, I don't know how, I don't know what form it will take. That's scary. I mean, that uncertainty, because I am sure that down the road you can really only push people so far. And even if you have the best brainwashing techniques in the world, even if you have what Joseph Goebbels would have loved to have, which was television, washing people's synapses 24 hours a day, you still can only push people so far before something bad happens.
And God knows what form that something bad will take. All right, thanks for joining us, Gary Indiana.
My pleasure. Thank you very much for having me on your program.
Gary Indiana, author of Schwarzenegger Syndrome, Politics and Celebrity in the Age of Contempt, a very fine book. I enjoyed it a lot, just out from the New Press. And we'll be back in a little bit right after this break.
Hi, this is Danny Glovin. You're tuned in to WBAI, listener-supported, non-commercial radio in New York.
Moorish, Orthodox, Radio, Crusade, Anarchism for the Global City, Radical Environmentalism for the Concrete Jungle, Esoteric Explorations of the Secret History of Rebel Culture. Every Tuesday at midnight after the news on listener-supported, non-commercial WBAI 99.5.
And we're back. It's Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and really is a very smart and entertaining book, Schwarzenegger Syndrome. It's just out from the New Press, and short, too, for those of us with short attention spans. And we'll take another little musical break and then hear from Susan Willis.
We got spaces, cities have their neighborhoods, and more.
And that late 80s, I believe, from Husker Du, Flip Your Wig, Divide and Conquer. I've got 9-digit zip codes and subdivision and all kinds of things, which is a nice setup for this interview recorded earlier today with Susan Willis, who is a professor of English at Duke and author of Portents of the Real, a Primer for Post 9/11 America, just published by Verso. And I apologize if there are any little glitches in this a sound file, because my computer was acting up this afternoon, so I think I conquered most of the glitches, but one or two may have survived. But anyway, Susan Willis. Welcome to WBAI, Susan Willis. It was a few years ago that we saw flags all over the place after 9/11. They've sort of receded somewhat, and some of the older ones may have faded now, but what did you make of that proliferation of flags in the months after 9/11?
Well, a person on the left who has never really been exposed to such a dose of what I would say is nationalism rather than simple patriotism, I think it was something of an overwhelming shock. But yet at the same time, because I work in cultural studies, I'm always quite interested in how people make sense of their lives, and particularly sense of their daily lives. So I began watching to see how flags were displayed, where we put them, how people related to them. And not only did we stick them in our SUVs and parade through the streets and hang them over the freeway overpasses, we put them by our mailboxes. Maybe we remembered the postal workers who had got caught in the anthrax. I don't know. I mean, I think that we used the flag in many ways.
Such as?
The flag is supposed to have one particular meaning, the meaning of the United States. But when we use a flag in our daily lives, we instill it with the meanings that we hope it will have and that we hope it will convey to others. If we put a flag by our mailbox, did we give remembrance to the postal workers that our own government had forgotten, had not preserved and protected in the same way that our government protected the people working in Senator Hart's office building? Maybe people, when they displayed their flags, were giving that type of recognition to workers who were being under-recognized.
There's also kind of a chip-on-the-shoulder quality to a lot of the flag display, wasn't there? It's like it's a challenge to those who weren't displaying the flag.
Yes, definitely. I did not have a flag on my car. And I can tell you that I was very often treated to a sort of posse on the highways, my car being kind of shuttled to the side or attacked by the cars that were bearing their flags. Yeah, I think there was a chip on the shoulder. It also put a lot of people who were not, who wanted to show a kind of solidarity and a sense of a commitment to America and to what America stands for, but didn't quite want to go as deeply as what the route that was being laid out for us, and attempted to fly instead flags with photos of the Earth taken from space as a way of trying to find an alternative memento.
That doesn't have quite the history or the force of arms behind it that a flag does.
It might be the new globalized look, though.
Now, we've also seen this proliferation of ribbons everywhere, the Support the Troops ribbons on cars. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Well, we have in our folkloric past the notion of tying a ribbon of remembrance, maybe on the gatepost, on the lilac bush. This is part of America's folklore. Now we have them in magnetic stickers and we put them on our cars. Again, it's interesting that these are displayed particularly on cars. I think that in this way, Americans truly do recognize that our comfort and our possibility of a future really is connected to the car and to a ready supply of oil. So in some ways, the remembrance of the troops gives kind of a subconscious recognition that the fate of the troops and all of our fates is tied to the production, consumption, distribution of oil.
Speaking of carbon, have a chapter on the anthrax attacks that came shortly after 9/11, and I hadn't realized that anthrax and anthracite come from the same root. What do you make of that?
Well, I come out of literature, so I'm used to seeing metaphors, reading words for their meanings and hidden meanings. And so for me, the anthrax hoaxes, not the anthrax attacks, but the hoaxes took on a resonance. And
there were over 15,000, you said, right?
Oh, yes. In fact, possibly quite a bit more. And what's most interesting about the anthrax hoaxes is that they began to occur, if you remember, only 2 months after the attacks on the World Trade Center. We were in a state of shock as a nation, reeling in both disbelief and deep pain, anxiety, fear. And yet, oddly enough, tens of thousands, even hundreds of us, began to send or leave false anthrax, in letters, on production lines, in school classrooms, on airplanes. The felony conviction rate kind of doubled, and people's supposed penalties mounted. Still, the anthrax threats went on. Now, for me, that was extremely interesting. I wanted to know not just why people were doing this, but what does it mean?
And what does it mean?
Well, this is where I went into the idea of anthrax coming from anthracite and its connection to coal, anthrax as a poison, anthrax in its relationship to coal as a pollutant. And I began to see that just as we were sending these anthrax hoaxes through the mail, the sky over lower Manhattan was besieged in what we called the plume of toxins. New Yorkers were breathing the toxins, even while false anthrax was going through the mail. All of this became something of a metaphor for the kinds of ways we unconsciously recognize that we were being subjected to pollutants. Things worse than anthrax were in the air.
And then not long after all this, there was the sniper or the snipers around Washington, D.C., and that created a whole new atmosphere of actually militarized fear. So what did you make of that? Those incidents?
Yes, as you're ticking off the questions, you notice that my book is something of a journal of the post-9/11 experience, beginning with the flags, including then the anthrax, and just a year later, right at the first, just following the first anniversary of 9/11, the Washington, D.C. snipers. I come from a state in the South, North Carolina. It's a state that is heavily committed to the military. It's very much, let's say the daily life in North Carolina always takes account of military families. What's interesting about the sniper is that John Allen Muhammad, as it turned out, and yet newspapers tried to make account of him, his as a lost soul, certainly Malvo was described as a lost soul, tried to describe why Muhammad would do this from a more psychological point of view. Very few accounts looked at Muhammad as a returning vet, looked at what it's like to be a returning vet in this country, and who was questioning why a returning vet bought a rifle, which is the civilian equivalent of a military rifle.
Named, ironically enough, the Bushmaster.
Exactly. We have lots of Bushes in the news constantly. Turned his car into something of a military assault vehicle, trained his young protege sort of the teammanship that is needed to function as a military sniper.
And they had a sort of father-son relationship.
That, too. And then rained terror down on civilians. So what was interesting to me in thinking about the sniper is what exactly is the relationship between civilian population and military population? What is the status of a civilian population in a world where we bring war to more and more civilians? It was interesting, too, to me that when, just as we finally apprehended Mohammed, the Russians had managed to gas 100 of their own civilians in a Moscow theater. So John Allen Muhammad raised for me the questions of civilians, the military, who's protecting who, whose life is at stake.
I'm speaking with Susan Willis, who is the author of Portents of the Real, a primer for post 9/11 America, just published by Verso. You make the point that we tend to think of the way our empire works as here operating on something out there. And you're arguing that it's really, there's really no inside and outside. It's kind of everywhere. And this sort of blowback, as people say, is really an integral part of the way empire works at present. Could you talk some about that?
Yeah, we were just talking about the embeddedness of the military in many of our states. And I used the example of a military operation that happens in North Carolina on a yearly basis. It's called Operation Robin Sage. And in it, it gives a good example of the ways in which a us, them, here, there, military, civilian distinctions truly break down, and the way in which we cannot quite hold any longer this notion of us on a sort of an island nation separate from the rest of the troubled geographies of the world, and them over there where we wish to have the wars, not have them come home to us. So Operation Robin Sage is really curious, but at the same time quite emblematic of this lack of distinction. In it, many counties of North Carolina are described as a mythic country of Pineland, which has been taken over by a tyrant. So the mission for newly training Green Berets is to be parachuted in to Pineland and to carry on a war gaming experience in which they save Pineland from the tyrant. So what really complicates all of this is that the residents of Pineland, the civilian population of the counties of North Carolina that are employed in the war game, get truly integrated and carried away by the notion of the war game. Many of them have roles to play in the war game. Some of them wear uniforms. Because this is a Green Beret training, many of the Green Berets in this guerrilla warfare do not wear uniforms. So you can begin to see that if civilian population is wearing uniforms, some of the military people are not wearing uniforms, it starts to be a little difficult to tell who's who is playing the role of a terrorist, who's playing the role of a guerrilla fighter, who's playing the role of the military saviors. And it becomes quite complicated when you factor in weaponry.
And at one of these, a couple of years ago, a sheriff shot a couple of these people. I think they were criminals, right?
Yes, exactly. And I think that this story did make it to New York, and maybe New Yorkers chortled over how silly North Carolinians are. But indeed, the sad case really does demonstrate the lack of maintaining distinctions between civilians and military. In this particular episode, a sheriff's deputy who was not at that point playing the war game, but who nevertheless lived in one of these counties, stopped what he thought was a suspicious vehicle. And in the vehicle, there was a civilian who was acting as chauffeur for two military men who were out of dress, thus appearing to be civilians. When the sheriff noticed that one of the military people reached into the back seat for what clearly was some type of weapon, he shot and killed one of the military people and wounded the other. And indeed, you see, when things become indistinct, the military inside the vehicle thought that the soldier was playing his role as a scripted sheriff. The sheriff, of course, was not scripted. There's no way to read whose side you're on. Let's put it this way. If you're not with us, you're against us, right? Well, there's no way to read it that way.
Well, it seems like we have such a thoroughly militarized society that the boundaries all break down. And, well, Tim McVeigh was a Gulf War veteran, the sniper of Muhammad, former military. God only knows what the returnees from the Iraq War are going to be like when they come back to civilian life.
Yes, that is certainly, I mean, if we imagine, I don't want to become an alarmist, but certainly if we imagine John Allen Muhammad, the plight of Muhammad somehow amplified by the great numbers of returnees. But what I was particularly thinking is that we too, many of us who are not in the military with the volunteer army, I think that many of us wish to maintain some kind of separation between us and them. That's an experience for the military, right? They volunteer, they go there, they're recruited as high schoolers out of our high schools. Somehow the middle class, or many members of the middle class, many members of people in more comfortable situations, want to kind of imagine that this is not happening to us in a larger sense as a nation. Now, imagine the great numbers of troops who are being forced into extended tours of duty, being called back when they thought their time was up. Think of all the many of them who are undergoing extreme duress. And we wish somehow to cut a line of distinction between that experience. That's the military life. That's separate from the life of people who go to jobs in the city or who work in other ways. But in fact, this is us. I think we should stop drawing the lines of distinction and begin to recognize that all of this is totally interconnected.
But I would say much of the trauma of 9/11 for a lot of Americans was that boundary between us and them was ruptured very dramatically. And we just couldn't get our heads around that. It's very difficult for Americans to think of themselves as living in the violent world we help create.
Yeah, I think that's true. Although I don't know that I want to say this, but it is quite quirky. Because I do live in the South, and because the South is for a large part still remembering the Civil War, a lot of Southerners really kind of thought, whoop, that would really only happen in the North. And there is kind of a sense that even while the U.S. is being pulled to recognize the extent to which we as a superpower really are bound up in the world's politics, economics, environmental distress, everything. Most of us, I think most of America, really still imagine some kind of privileged disconnect.
And then finally, it was about a week ago, a week ago exactly, that the bombs blew up in London. Any thoughts on how that is like or unlike the 9/11 experience and how British people have reacted against the way Americans have reacted?
Well, most people who comment go to the notion of Britain as a place that has experienced previous forms of attack. Certainly the years of the IRA. And I think for a large extent, European nations as a whole have had a longer recognition of attack as part of a complicated politics and history. I don't think that our immediate lumping of attack or willingness to see attack as a sort of on the proportions of a blockbuster movie that describes things in terms of evil doers and nice people is something that the British have fallen prey to. I think that there's much more of an ability to understand or to think politically in Europe and in Britain than there is in the United States. I noticed that in some of the coverage on the cable news that there really is a strong mission to try to prevent racialized forms of retribution, and it will be very important to see if in Britain this bombings in the subway do or do not spin into violent forms of retribution against immigrant communities.
And that was Susan Willis, author of Portents of the Real, a primer for post-9/11 America. She teaches English at Duke University, and the book just out from Verso. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news. I'll be back next week with the mysterious fundraising edition. Until then, let's go out with a little bit more of Husker Du's Divide and Conquer. Till next week. Bye.